This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
This week on Witness History, the Unabomber terrorized Americans in a 17-year bombing campaign, killing 3 people. I've been speaking to Special Agent Kathleen Puckett, who reveals how the FBI tracked him down. Listen on Witness History, the podcast that takes you to the biggest moments in history, told by the people who were there. Search and subscribe to Witness History wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
It's 1945. The Nazis have blockaded the Netherlands by land and sea. No food imports can get in, and extreme hunger is starting to claim lives. In The Hague, the Juliana Children's Hospital is struggling to feed its young patients. So much so that the director, Dr. Wilhelm Dicker, has even allowed tulip bulbs to be given as food. But the alternative is death from starvation. Some of the children are thriving. In particular, a group with a debilitating condition called G. Herter's syndrome. They seem to be getting better. What was going on? How did tulip bulbs help to free thousands of people from suffering? And what did all of this have to do with bananas? I'm Hannah Fry, a mathematician who studies patterns in human behaviour. This is Uncharted, Tales of Data and Discovery. Our story begins a few decades earlier in New York in the late 1800s, long before the children in the Juliana Hospital were even a twinkle in their parents' eye. This was a time when, for medical purposes, children were regarded as little more than small adults. But a few notable doctors disagreed and fought to get pediatrics established as a distinct discipline. One of the men leading the charge was the no-nonsense New York doctor, Luther Emmett Holt.
He was a very prominent physician, and more important, he led Babies Hospital, which was the most important hospital for infants and babies in New York, and he published the most influential manual on infant feeding.
This is Professor Emily Abel, a historian of medicine from UCLA.
The rate of infant mortality was extremely high, and there was a belief that infant feeding really held the clue.
Nearly a third of babies born in America in the 1880s would not live to see their 5th birthday. Holt became convinced that nutrition was key to preventing some of those deaths. And so, using money from the Rockefeller family to fund his research, Holt looked into the cow's milk being sold in New York and discovered that much of it was teeming with dangerous bacteria. With a combination of careful science and political savvy, Holt successfully campaigned for a testing and pasteurization regime that led to huge improvements in milk quality. But this story is about another problem that Holt wrestled with, one he couldn't quite solve. Among a group of young patients under his care, he noticed a cluster of especially challenging symptoms.
The affected children had a distinct form of diarrhea, and those children who were affected lagged behind their age mates in physical development.
These children were eating normally, but it looked like their bodies weren't absorbing the nutrients. They were weak and tired, and their growth was severely stunted. Holt got a group of other doctors interested in the condition, including one Christian Herter. Herter studied a series of infants with these symptoms, and what he encountered was bleak. Here, he describes a young girl.
By the 3rd year, development became much retarded. Child markedly undersized, digestive tract irritable. Fat absorption much impaired, abdomen much distended.
the condition became known as G. Herter's disease. But despite Christian Herter's best efforts, what was really causing it and the best way to treat it remained elusive. At the turn of the century, the introduction of refrigerated cargo shipping opened up vast new markets. Suddenly, it was possible to grow exotic fruits in one country and transport them long distances while keeping them fresh, particularly fruits like the banana.
Start them off with a smile with Chiquita bananas. Chiquita bananas give them a nutrition and energy lift that will carry them.
Once bananas entered the American diet, some doctors noticed the impact they appeared to have on patients with G. Herter's disease. One study in 1924 reports.
Heretofore, it has been impossible in the severe cases to give any carbohydrate without damage, whereas banana is not only well-tolerated, but rapidly changes the entire picture of the disease to one of well-being, making it possible to bring about a clinical cure in practically all cases.
Messages like this were amplified by the companies importing and marketing fruit, and the banana diet took off. And not just as a cure for the G. Herter's children.
Bananas are so good for you and so easy to digest, doctors often recommend them as one of baby's first solid foods.
But in 1941, a rude shock.
When World War II began, there was enormous panic for mothers because they no longer could secure bananas. And so mothers of children with this special condition really panicked.
The New York Times covered stories of some desperate banana hunts, including this piece on the 31st of July, 1942.
Brooklyn police found 24 ripe bananas in the borough yesterday after a frantic search for the fruit, which was urgently needed for the diet of a 15-month-old baby.
And here's the thing. The bananas were helping. The babies with G. Herter's could eat them without suffering debilitating symptoms. But the American medics had missed something crucial, something that one doctor in the Netherlands was onto. Back in The Hague, Dr. Wilhelm Dicker had long known that G. Herter's disease was somehow connected with diet. But Dicker was not convinced by the banana theory. He suspected another foodstuff, something much more important and ubiquitous. One of the staple foods for Dutch children at the time was wheat porridge. And Dicker had heard stories from mothers that replacing wheat porridge with rice could wipe out G. Herter-like symptoms. He floated the possibility with some colleagues, but the idea was dismissed and ridiculed.
There was a lot of laughing about this because at that time we had also the first Catholic university in the Netherlands.
This is Professor Chris Mulder, a gastroenterologist from Amsterdam UMC.
The Catholics have their so-called Catholic cookies, the hosties.
The most sacred moment in a communion service involves eating a wafer, which according to Catholic doctrine, literally transforms into the body of Christ.
And this is pure wheat. So the Catholic doctors there were criticizing this idea that rice would be good and wheat would be bad, because they say the body of the Lord can't be bad for children.
But Dicker didn't let it go, and his hypothesis was put to the test when World War II brought the brutal hunger winter. After a failed Allied attempt to liberate the Netherlands in 1944, the Nazis blockaded the northern part of the country by land and sea. Imports of potatoes, sugar, flour, all of the staples were totally cut off. And by 1945, millions of residents in The Hague, in Rotterdam and Amsterdam were beginning to starve. Tens of thousands would eventually die. But in The Hague, this horrendous suffering allowed Dicker to see one small ray of light. Dicker realised his theory about wheat was being unexpectedly confirmed.
He was director of the Juliana Children's Hospital, and it was no bread, no wheat in the Netherlands, though. And that was the clue.
This is Professor Louisa Meeren, a paediatrician following in Dr. Dicker's footsteps. She specialises in what we've been calling G. Herter's disease, the disease now more commonly known as celiac.
Because he saw that most of the children were getting sicker without good food, without bread, But the children with celiac disease, they got better.
So bananas were not the cure. It was a simple error of correlation being mistaken for causation. The same with tulip bulbs. Both, of course, were fine for celiac children, but simply because they don't contain wheat. The absence of that one staple food, it transpired, had the power to alleviate suffering for thousands. Or it would have if Dicker had been believed. And then once the Nazis were beaten into retreat, a flood of fresh supplies started coming in by land and air, and the celiac children started to suffer again. And to finally convince the medical establishment that there was a treatment for these suffering children, he had to gather the proper evidence. He led a series of careful studies analysing the digestion of celiac children with and without wheat-containing diets. And buried in this work, there is one graph in particular that captures the life-changing power of his discovery. It is the growth curve for a single boy known only by his initials, GH. Along the bottom axis, age is marked from 1 to 14. Up the side is his height in centimetres. A dotted curve traces the growth of a typical healthy child, zipping up from 70 centimetres at 1 year to 100 centimetres at 4, and then the curve bends a little, the rate of growth starting to slow, so that by 8 years old, a healthy boy stands, on average, at 125 centimetres tall. Next to that, GH's height is plotted. As a two-year-old, he is already falling behind. And by the age of five, his growth has plateaued for 3 years. He is 20 centimetres shorter than he should be, and his health is suffering. At that point, GH is admitted to hospital under Dr. Dicker's care. He moves to a wheat-free diet, and the change is marked. Over the next few months, his height begins to shoot up again. With his body being properly nourished, GH is catching up. And this pattern occurs again and again. While GH avoids wheat, his growth accelerates. When he leaves the hospital, it slows once more.
We use these diagrams to monitor the growth of the children. But when the gluten-free diet is a start, they have what we call a catch-up growth. And they grow very rapidly during the first 2 years of the gluten-free diet.
With this simple line tracing a child's growth, Dr. Dicker had shown that children with celiac could live a healthy and happy life. After Dicker published these results, doctors around the globe started to get the message. Here's Chris Mulder again.
So suddenly there was an explosion of articles about gluten-free diet from the UK in 1952 in The Lancet, in Norway, Germany in 1953. Within 10 years after his first description, the whole world was completely convinced that he was right.
At least 1% of the population has celiac disease. Even if you only take into account the people who are diagnosed with celiac disease, there are thousands and thousands and thousands in the whole world.
In 1962, the Nobel Prize Committee was on the cusp of contacting its list of winners. Among them, one Dr. Wilhelm Dicker. But sadly, just a week before the announcement, Dicker passed away. Nobel Prizes aren't awarded posthumously, but it's pretty clear that he deserved one. His growth curves tell the story of his greatest triumph, the possibility of a normal life for tens of thousands of children and adults around the world. Back in the Netherlands, Professor Louisa Meeren, who specialises in helping children with celiac disease, is continuing his work.
The biggest challenge now is to get all the people with celiac disease diagnosed. We also have now rapid tests that in 10 minutes you get a result. So the diagnosis is very easy. It's cheap. We can do it in young children before they get symptoms, actually. And we should do it.
Next on Uncharted for Discovery, a young woman's journey through physics leads her to unexpected outcomes.
This story starts in a shabby brick hut next to a disused railway. It's November 1967 and a young researcher is working alone. But she's forcing herself to concentrate, checking through metres and metres of graph paper as it's pushed steadily out of a printer. is the output from a huge antenna turned to the sky, a giant ear listening for cosmic whispers. The antenna has taken 2 years to build, and now it's time to listen. She spots an odd-looking squiggle on the graph, and then another. It's probably just the usual interference, she thinks. Perhaps a car starting up in the distance or a lawnmower. But wait, maybe she's seen something like this before. Best to investigate, she decides, just in case. It's taken her years of work to get here, in an environment not exactly welcoming to women. She doesn't want to mess up, to embarrass herself. And the signal is bizarre. Could it even be some kind of alien communication? What unfolds from that moment is a discovery that would shake the world of astronomy. I'm Hannah Fry, a mathematician who studies patterns in human behaviour. This is Uncharted, Tales of Data and Discovery. Just a few years earlier, in 1963, Jocelyn Bell Burnell is an undergraduate at the University of Glasgow. But she's got more than the usual student anxieties to contend with.
I was the only female in my undergraduate class, 49 men and me. And it was, quote, the tradition that when a woman entered the lecture theatre, all the guys would whistle and stamp and catcall, bang their desks, make as much noise as they could. For my final 2 years as a physics undergraduate, I was the only female and had to face that on my own.
Jocelyn was steadfast in her determination to study physics, and she was captivated in particular by the physics of the stars. Because through the 50s and early 60s, a discipline called radio astronomy had blossomed into a dynamic new area of research. As magnetic fields spin, radio waves are thrown off, not unlike the spray of droplets from a dog shaking itself dry. Celestial objects like the sun, the stars, even black holes are constantly throwing out electromagnetic whispers into the void of space. Whispers which, if we can hear them, are rich with clues about their sources. Radio astronomy is a way of eavesdropping on fantastically distant objects and overhearing their secrets. Jocelyn was hooked.
I arrived in Cambridge, rather to my surprise, in 1965. I'd never expected to get a place there, but I thought I'd better apply just in case. The place was full of young men, extremely confident ex-public school young men. And here am I from the north and west of the country. Never having done any Plato or anything like that, I'm a scientist. And I thought, oh my God, I'm not clever enough to be here.
Despite her doubts, Jocelyn joined a group led by the brilliant but intimidating Tony Hewish to search for something particular.
It was a brand new project to look for quasars, quasi-stellar radio sources.
Astronomers knew there were these distinctive sources of radio waves from extremely distant objects that looked a bit like stars, but they didn't yet know what they were. Jocelyn's job, her PhD topic, was to find more of them. But to do that, they needed to build the right kind of antenna, a giant ear turned to the sky, listening at just the right frequency. The mystique and the drama of space. It took her to a muddy field outside of Cambridge.
If you know what a hop field looks like, it really looks rather like a hop field. A lot of wooden posts, a lot of wires strung between the wooden posts. The one thing that's different from a hop field is there were cables, black polythene-covered cables, picking up the signals from the wires, which were the radio aerials, and taking those signals to radio receivers back in a hut. My main job was connectors, ways of joining cables and ways of joining antenna into cables and that kind of thing.
It took Jocelyn and a team of six others 2 long years of consistent work before they could turn on their listening device. And then, radio waves that had travelled through the dark vastness of space for thousands and thousands of years would find their way to this muddy field. Electrons would be jostled and a small electric current would flow. That current would trickle into the cold brick hut to move a small arm holding a shop-bought ink pen.
It was a squiggly red line on a roll of graphed paper. And the size of the wiggle that the pen makes is a measure of the strength of the radio signal. The loudness, if we use an audio an allergy.
Jocelyn was trying to hear the whispers from billions or trillions of miles away. But often, more earthly signals would come through.
We had a lot of trouble with Radio Caroline, moored off the Dutch coast, broadcasting on one of our frequencies that was meant to be kept clear for radio astronomy. Badly suppressed cars could also give radio emission.
It required constant vigilance. Jocelyn was diligent and thorough, despite the bleak conditions.
I do remember going out there at 2 a.m. on a frosty January and hoping I didn't skid and fall off and fall into the ditch and this kind of thing.
But thanks to that diligence, the work was going well. The team were picking up evidence of quasars, the things they had set out to find. But then one day, Jocelyn noticed a very unusual kind of signal.
Well, the first time I saw it, it was on my regular chart recording. Looks a bit like quasar, a bit like radio interference, doesn't quite look like either.
Jocelyn pulled old graphs from shoeboxes, graphs relating to the same bit of the sky from previous days and weeks. The graphs were showing sudden, brief swells in the radio signal, but periodic, like pulses. So they had cropped up before. But now, studying the pattern, she had no idea what they might be.
So I go to my supervisor and say, "What do you think this is? It doesn't look like a quasar." And my thesis advisor was not impressed. He was quite certain I'd done something wrong or we're picking up interference. You know, things in the sky don't give a string of pulses every second. They just don't.
If the signal was junk, it would be a terrible humiliation. So without telling anyone, Jocelyn and Tony started working through likely sources of local interference, eliminating them one by one. But they couldn't explain the pulses away. They kept coming. But what were they? There was only one thing for it. A bigger, muddier field. A different giant ear was required. Could another antenna pick up the same mysterious set of pulses? They made arrangements with colleagues working just a few miles away.
And I vividly remember that test because it was really crucial. There was a research student, another research student on it called Robin, and his thesis advisor, Paul. And my telescope, the way it was positioned, saw the thing first, and there it was, pulsing nicely. So we went and stood by the pen recorder for Robin's telescope, and nothing happened. So the two academics started walking down this long lab saying, "Now, what could it be that shows in this recorder but not that one? Could it? No, it can't be that. Well, what about? No, it can't be that." And I'm padding along behind them, trying to keep up. And Robin has stayed by his pen recorder. And we just got down to the far end of the lab and the voice from Robin says, "Here it is!" We came rushing back. He had miscalculated by 5 minutes when his telescope would see that bit of sky. If he had miscalculated by 25 minutes, we'd have all gone home.
Eventually, they were sure. They were picking up something real, something new.
The fact that it was pulsing at a period of a second, one and a third second, something like that, was really shocking. Stars are really, really big things. Big things don't do things quickly. You know, elephants are slow and cumbersome. It's the fleas that can nip around. This thing, whatever it is more like a flea than an elephant, but stuff out in space ought to be elephant-like. So what the heck is going on?
Could it even be an extraterrestrial intelligence trying to communicate? Well, Tony Hewish, Jocelyn's supervisor, thought so. Here he is much later in a BBC interview from 1980.
The whole nature of the signal looked so artificial that one could scarcely conceive of an astronomical object, a normal star, behaving in this way. A much simpler explanation would be that there are radio transmitters by intelligent beings placed out there in the galaxy, and perhaps they are in fact trying to talk to you. And that's why we nicknamed these things LGMs at the very beginning for our little green men.
After weeks of checking and analysing and debating, they came to a startling conclusion. It wasn't little green men. It had to be a bizarre new kind of object.
We now know that these things we call pulsars, pulsating radio stars, they're the remnants of very big stars, much, much bigger than our sun, big stars that at the end of their life explode. catastrophically. And in the explosion, the core of the star gets compressed and ends up being about 10 miles across, which by astronomical standards is microscopic. And because it was a spinning object that shrunk, it's now spinning faster.
Imagine an ice skater spinning on the spot with one leg stretched out. As the skater draws their leg in, they start to spin faster and faster. It's the same with a pulsar. The explosive compression takes it from hundreds of thousands of miles across, spinning slowly, to something more like the size of a city. And as it shrinks, the angular momentum is conserved and it speeds up thousands and thousands of times. That compression also makes it unimaginably dense. A single drop of a pulsar would weigh more than the Titanic. Impossibly dense, impossibly fast. And as they spin, pulsars emit a continuous blast of radio waves. Each time these waves sweep around, they line up momentarily with a field outside Cambridge, like a torch briefly flicking across our eyes. Pulsars opened up a whole new area of physics and a whole new area of astronomy. We have now found thousands more dotted throughout the Milky Way, and they have become a powerful tool. They've been able to test Einstein's theory of general relativity, and astronomers are now using their pulses as incredibly accurate galactic clocks to measure the stretching and the squeezing of the universe, to map the very fabric of space-time as it ripples with gravitational waves. In 1972, the Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded for the discovery of pulsars, but not to Jocelyn. It was her supervisor, Tony Hewish, who got the recognition. But Jocelyn's story and her legacy, it didn't end there. In 2018, she got some startling news.
One day, out of nowhere, got a message that say, "Congratulations, you've won the Breakthrough Prize. It's $3 million. $3 million. Oh, my God. And so I phoned up the chief executive of the Institute of Physics and said, "Would you like $3 million to fund female graduate students?" And he said, "Yes." I don't suppose he gets many phone calls like that.
The scholarship Jocelyn established has already funded research places for scores of underrepresented students in physics and will continue to run for many decades into the future.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice, and for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.